Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. It's a pleasure to welcome back into the ABC studios once again Luke Geary of Salvos Legal. Luke, hi.
G'day, John.
It's been a very difficult week or so for those interested in the limits of the law and the limits to pressure and what justice means, as we've looked at the Chan and Sukumaran cases internationally. Indonesia goes through its own processes. There's political resistance to interference in the affairs of another sovereign nation. But there are a couple of elements we can usefully talk about. One, of course, is the whole general question of Australians overseas. You know, beware of what you're doing. You're not a value-free unit, or you're not a sovereign individual.
Yeah.
What's your advice to Australians going overseas? I don't mean don't carry bags of heroin.
But yeah, I think just obeying the laws of where you're going is a good start. But look, I guess ultimately everyone must appreciate that foreign countries have sovereignty as a principle in which they will make determinations on what laws they have and how they will enforce them, irrespective of the origin of the person that comes to their country.
And as an Australian going overseas, you might carry the goodwill and good wishes of our government, but not the legal protections of our government.
No, the government can't intervene in the affairs of that sovereign nation. And the whole point of sovereignty as a, I guess, as a principle of international law is that a country will be absolutely autonomous in its determination of the ways in which people will have to follow its laws and processes, and it's only really subject to international laws which it may offend.
The government had to tread a very fine line here, balancing what it thought would be effective against the danger of giving offence, which would be a negative. Just as a lawyer watching it, did you feel for them at every... I'm not just meaning Andrew Chan and Myron Sukumaran, but the government officials charged with nuancing this.
Yeah, look, obviously it's highly politically charged, and you can't possibly properly estimate the complexity of the all the discussions that are not publicised and the impact of the various, in this instance, Indonesian political debates that were happening within the country. You know, we only saw part of Australia's perspective and only those conversations which were appropriate to be aired. I'm sure there were many which happened behind closed doors which tiptoed amongst all of those sensitivities and the egos and the personalities involved, but also the simply complex legal and moral issues that were at hand.
Did you feel reasonably comfortable as somebody experienced in the law watching the public debate about the way this was handled, or were you at times saying, "Oh, why don't they do this? Why don't they do that? Why don't they?"
There were a lot of great minds involved in doing everything they could to assist these men, and unfortunately, despite those best efforts and the prayers of many, it wasn't able to get a better outcome.
Well, let's go to the heart of the issue, because it does come down, whether you're in Australia or Indonesia, to what the purpose of sentencing people to prison is. That is, in the Indonesian case, you seem to have a retributive view, that is, that these people did a crime, they must go for the punishment. And the reformatory view, that is, that there had been an effective rehabilitation, didn't seem to get much of a look in.
Yeah, look, it was a very hard line approach taken over there, and certainly it's difficult to comprehend from Australian perspectives, because, I mean, just to give an example, in New South Wales we have seven separate principles in which courts will look to whenever sentencing an offender for an offence, and none of them amongst the seven are given specific hierarchy or precedence above any of the others. They're all part of the mix, and each of them are seen as key elements in determining the proper means by which a person will be sentenced for a crime.
So what are the seven elements?
So the first one is to ensure that the offender obviously is adequately punished for the offence. The second is to prevent crime by deterring an offender and others from committing an offence or similar offences. The third is an important one, of course, to protect the community from the offender. The fourth, and this is the one perhaps you were alluding to, is the promotion of rehabilitation of the offender. I just pause there for a minute. And so obviously the first four you've heard are, you know, there's a degree of tension of the interests. You have the community interest, you have the individual as in the interest of the victim, the person seeking punishment or a form of retribution. And you have, of course, the interest of the offender, him or herself, and the desire or hopeful outcome of rehabilitation. Continuing on, you have the notion, and this is again for the offender, him or herself, the notion of requiring that offender to be accountable for his or her actions. It's a very personal, subjective principle.
And that is basically a very old idea about confession is good for the soul sort of thing.
It is a means of deterrence. Yeah, yes. It's a means of deterrence of that individual. So it's a subjective deterrent. Then you have the denouncement of the conduct of the offender, and that hopefully will have a more broad, objective consequence in telling others who might have considered similar offending that it's not a very sensible thing to do. And lastly, to recognise the harm done to the victim of the crime and to the community.
And as you say, they're all held in tension. They're not a hierarchy.
No, and so, you know, sometimes you hear lawyers like myself from time to time who have a candidate who has been guilty of committing a crime, and all crimes have victims, whether they are an individual victim or the community as a whole. You have a victim who perhaps has suffered to a moderate degree rather than a more severe instance, and then you have a candidate, a criminal offender, who has come full circle from being a very serious person with very little prospect and having undertaken some form of rehabilitation, having a really positive outlook on their future. And a lawyer such as myself at Salvos Legal might come and do their best to propose to the court that that offender should be given the benefit of the doubt, and that the principle in this instance of rehabilitation should be given the greatest importance. Whilst those arguments can be compelling, it's not a requirement of the court to accept them, because out of those seven principles, rehabilitation is merely one.
Well, let's take the interesting case of the death penalty, because here is the issue a lot of people say of deterrence. That is, the death penalty is the ultimate sanction. You want to really deter them? You tell them they die if they do it.
Mm.
Yet legal scholars and prison scholars around the world are saying there is no evidence anywhere that the death penalty, the sanction of the death penalty, is a deterrent.
Yeah, look, John, there's been some work done in America particularly, which really considers this exact issue across a range of jurisdictions. And there was a study done over the last decade which examined the propensities of criminal behaviour in states which had the death penalty and states which did not have the death penalty. And the result of the study was that those which had the death penalty and which had imposed the death penalty had no more positive record of, diminished offending behaviour than those which didn't.
So the only reason for the death penalty in those cases is retribution.
Well,
it has nothing to do with reformation.
It's hard to see how someone who's subject to the death penalty could later be reformed in this life.
Yes, because it's not a deterrent, it's not an aid for reformation, so it has a purely retributive element to it.
Well, it's hard to see how it could be argued as a principle for protecting the community from the offender when life in prison or a substantial period of life in prison would have the same outcome.
Yes. I think, and this is just departing from our discussion for a moment, but I think one of the things that came out of the Chan and Sukumaran thing about the death penalty is ultimately the only people who suffer are the innocent families left behind.
Yeah, and look, I mean, let's be mindful as well. In that instance, you had two extended families who obviously do not get an opportunity to see that person come out of jail after a period of time or visit them in jail any longer. Those families grieve as all other victims might grieve, and those families have never been implicated in these crimes and haven't done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So that is
the burden of suffering is enormous.
It's immeasurable. The other thing is, I guess, you do have some crimes where death penalty can be imposed where the victim may not necessarily support it. And so the guilt that might flow from that is another immeasurable consequence.
Let's just pursue this the idea of these seven as they apply when you put people into the prison system. To what extent has our balance, or does our balance shift in our prison system, not just according to the judiciary, but according to the political and community norms of the time? That is, you find, for example, at the moment in Australia, we seem to be building more prisons and loading them up with people. How is that a reflection of the seven principles, or are we saying, look, there's something else that applies here too? It's a community ethos and it's political, the political dynamic as well.
Yeah, look, I guess it's difficult to say, John. What I see, I guess, on the front line is courts, and also in New South Wales particularly, I have a bit of interaction with the state, is insofar as innovative measures of sentencing offenders are, you know, very thirstily being sought after by courts and by, you know, the Attorney General's Department, because they see the benefits of treating the individual in a way which is fair to the individual as an offender, but recognising those principles, but also makes sense to the community and observes and respects those other principles.
But there seems to be nothing to put a flare in the nostrils of politicians sensing a delicate election coming on than to raise the law and order issue. Throw more people in prison, lock away, throw away the key.
I don't think it's new, though.
No. Well, it seems to become a technique in the last 30 years or so, because you see the way in which the debate about prison reform has constantly lost the battle against the throw more people in jail.
It's an easier argument, I guess, to say throw more people in jail because people will feel safer.
These places used to be called penitentiaries. The idea of penitence and reform was built into the system in some ways when it was designed.
I think, yeah, I guess when you politicise the issue rather than have those who are students of the law in a philosophical way rather than tertiary way. Students of society, you know, experts, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, people who work in the system every day, I'm sure you would have very different outlooks.
Yeah, it takes us to a much wider question, really, doesn't it? It's a whole part of this whole, I guess, populist notion of trashing expertise. They're the last people we want to hear from these days, which takes us into a much wider question. But it impacts on all sorts of elements in our society, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think they make incremental gains, John, and I think as we see in time, the runs will be on the board to support arguments other than the banging of the fist on the table at law and order time.
Are you concerned, as somebody who deals with the system, that we haven't got the balance quite right, that we seem to be loading our prisons? When you look at the Aboriginal prison population, for instance, or you look at the people with mental illness or drug addiction in prisons?
I think those cohorts of people are very important distinctions to make as opposed to the general population. So people from an Indigenous background or people who do suffer from mental illness or addiction, they are specific groups of people within the population, and there are some, there is quite a bit of evidence of them being treated in a different light to other offenders. But I think at the end of the day, you have a lot of people who are very good at what they do, putting a lot of time, a lot of effort into trying to find a better way.
Luke Geary of Salvos Legal, great as ever to have you in the studio. Thanks once again for coming along.
Thanks, John. Pleasure.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.